of young black boys living in Sanford, Florida, recently told Bay News 9, a local TV affiliate, that the killing of Trayvon Martin has changed their perception of the world around them. Martin Van Buren said, quote, "I've never really cared about the looks people gave me or anything, but seeing how people look at you feels like you're being judged now based on the color you are." The killing has sparked a much-needed conversation about how young black and brown people are perceived in our society. So on today's Your Call, we're talking about the realities of walking while black and brown. What conversations are you having about this issue? What about this case has sparked this conversation, and where do you want it to go from here? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. There's heightened tension along Syria's borders as doubts intensify about an international peace plan due to come into effect on Tuesday. In one incident, a Lebanese cameraman was shot dead on the Lebanese side of the border. Separately, three people were injured when the Syrian security forces fired at a refugee camp inside Turkey. In Syria itself, activists say 100 people have been killed. Jim Muir reports.
Turkey is furious that the Syrian army fired across the border, wounding several people, including a Turkish citizen. In northern Lebanon, a cameraman from a local TV station died and another was injured when their car came under a hail of gunfire from troops on the Syrian side of the border. Inside Syria itself, the situation was much worse. Under Kofi Annan's peace plan, the Syrian military and its heavy weaponry were supposed to have completed a withdrawal from population centres by Tuesday. Clearly, that's not happening.
The military in Yemen says at least 33 people, including 9 soldiers, have been killed in a suspected al-Qaeda attack on an army barracks. At least 18 al-Qaeda fighters were among those killed in the clashes in southern Yemen. At least 11 people have been killed by a bomb blast in the central Somali town of Baidoa. Here's our Africa editor, Mary Harper.
The governor of Bay region, Abdi Fitah Mohamed Gese, told the BBC the bomb was planted in a small basket and hidden in a busy market in the centre of town. Most of the dead and injured were women and children. Mr. Gese blamed the Islamist militia Al-Shabaab for the attack. Ethiopian troops in February seized Baidoa from Al-Shabaab, depriving them of one of their most strategic strongholds. A few days ago, about 100 African Union peacekeepers were deployed to Baidoa, the first time they've moved out of the capital, Mogadishu.
Flights between the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, and South Sudan have been suspended as part of a deepening dispute over the legal status of hundreds of thousands of southerners living north of the border. Travellers were turned away from Khartoum Airport after being told they needed passports for what was previously considered an internal flight. South Sudan declared independence last July. Since then, there's been no agreement on the paperwork needed for the southerners who stayed in the north. A court in India has found 23 people guilty of killing Muslims in the state of Gujarat during religious riots 10 years ago. Joe Jolly reports.
The 2002 religious riots in Gujarat shocked India with their ferocity and brutality. Those convicted by the court were part of a mob that set fire to a house where 23 Muslims, mainly women and children, had taken shelter. The victims were locked inside the house and all of them died. The religious riots broke out after a train carrying Hindu pilgrims was set alight by a mob. More than 1,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed in the ensuing violence.
World news from the BBC. Internet users in Iran say the authorities appear to have blocked the official website for the 2012 Olympic Games. Correspondents in Iran say web users trying to get access to the Olympic site are instead directed to an Iranian service. There's been no announcement by Tehran about why the site has been blocked. Bahrain's national carrier Gulf Air says its official page on the social media channel Facebook has been hacked for what it described as political purposes. The airline said it was working with law enforcement agencies to prosecute those involved. Posts on Facebook said the carrier's logo had been replaced by the image of an activist jailed for life for his part in anti-government protests in Bahrain last year. He has Danish citizenship, but Denmark's request that he be transferred to its custody has been rejected. A strongly pro-Russian former KGB officer has won the presidential election in the breakaway Georgian territory of South Ossetia. Leonid Tabilov's victory will increase tensions between Russia and Georgia. Damien McGuinness reports.
South Ossetia's new leader, Leonid Tibilov, says he would like South Ossetia to unify with North Ossetia, which is in Russia. effectively making the territory a part of Russia. But this would antagonize Georgia, which, supported by Europe and the US, regards South Ossetia as Georgian territory occupied by Russian troops. Moscow already supports South Ossetia financially and militarily.
President Obama is meeting his Brazilian counterpart, Dilma Rousseff, at the White House during her first official visit to the United States. Both leaders have said they want to boost trade between the two biggest economies in the Americas. Another focus is education, with Ms. Rousseff keen to increase the number of Brazilians who study in the US. Brazil also wants US support for its campaign to win a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The killing of Trayvon Martin has sparked a much-needed conversation about race in this country, in everyday interactions and in the media. Turay recently wrote a piece for Time magazine called How to Talk to Young Black Boys About Trayvon Martin, 8 Talking Points About the Potentially Fatal Condition of Being Black. In an NPR piece, Florida's Teen Killing, A Parent's Greatest Fear, Corey Dade writes, quote, I am a black man. This is one of the realities I have lived. My parents prepared me for it. My father, informed by his upbringing in the segregated South, and my mother, who faced racism in the integrated Midwest, were convinced this unofficial set of rules would save my life. Here are several of them. And he writes, 1, never leave a store without a shopping bag. 2, never loiter outside anywhere. 3, never go anywhere alone. 4, never talk back to police and never, ever reach into your pocket. And 5, never doubt trouble may strike anytime, anywhere. And in a separate NPR piece, Tim Irvin, a resident of Sanford, Florida, told NPR's Kathy Lohr, quote, I figure the whole world can see what's finally going on now, what's been going on in Sanford. Theo Hollerbach, the owner of a German restaurant called the Willow Tree Cafe, said the shooting and the protests have made him think about the issue of race. He said, quote, it really got to me, and it made me realize that, you know, some of the points of view I have that I didn't even see, and it made me reevaluate how I look at things. So on today's Your Call, we're spending the hour talking about this very important issue, what it means to grow up black and brown in the United States. What conversations are you having and hearing? How has this affected your daily interaction? And what is it about the killing of Trayvon Martin that's really sparked this conversation? Because black and brown people say this has been happening for decades. Why has it taken so long for us to really have a real conversation about this? And where should this conversation go from here? Today we are joined by Nubia Bowe. She's a high school graduate and a current Ella Baker Center for Human Rights Heal the Streets Leadership Fellow. And she joins us from Oakland. Hi, Nubia. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
It's nice to have you. Thanks for joining us.
No, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Chris Johnson is a local artist who co-created the Question Bridge Black Males exhibit, now showing at the Oakland Museum. The Art Media Project has collected answers and questions from over 150 black men in 11 cities across the U.S. It's showing until July 8th. Chris is also a professor of photography at the California College of the Arts, and he joins us in studio. Hi, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Unity Lewis, a hip-hop artist, painter, art educator, activist, and participant in the Question Bridge Project. And Unity is also in studio. Hi, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Great to have you. So, Chris, let's start off with you. You just completed this incredible project, and it's been amazing to read so many articles about what it means to be black and brown post in light of the Trayvon Martin killing. What is it about this killing that has really started this conversation?
Well, that's a really good question because, you know, analogies have been made to the Emmett Till case, which was, of course, very, very different. Unity and I were asking ourselves on the way over here, like why now? Like, what's going on? Maybe it's something about the sheer injustice of it. I think anybody understands that if the race of those two men had been different, that Trayvon would have been arrested. There's no question about that. But there's stark injustice all around us. I mean, there are lots of situations like this, the Oscar Grant. I mean, there's so many situations. So the question of why now is a really interesting cultural question for us to consider. I don't know.
And what are your thoughts on this? Because I was struck by watching the Sunday shows after this happened, and almost all of the talking heads, including the conservatives, said, you are automatically suspect if you are a black or brown young man in this society. You don't hear that very often some of these pundits.
I hear you, but it's something that I hear that I've grown up with. You know, my parents have told me that. It's just common knowledge, you know, when you're raised black, that, yeah, you're a target and you're suspect. And 9 times out of 10, we're in survival mode when we're out here because we could be doing the right thing and get shot down, you know?
So what is it about this case that has sparked this conversation?
Well, like Chris said, we were trying to figure it out. Does it have something to do with Trayvon Smile? Has something to do with his age? But really, when I heard, I wasn't surprised. You know, it's just another case, and it happens every year, you know, countless cases and many that don't get reported. You know.
And what do you think, Nubia? What is it about this case that's really sparked such an honest conversation about walking or just being black and brown in our society?
Well, honestly, like the other two gentlemen said, like, to me, it is pretty normal for African American people. And I can't really speak to it all the way because I'm not a male. You know, It is a different set of circumstances for African-American males in America. But the fact that there was, you know, like the 911 calls where he's like, these guys always get away with things. That to me seems like the difference between every other shooting that has probably been over race and completely unfair and unjust. That seems like the one factor that, you know, the fact that we're getting all these 911 calls where you can hear him saying, help, help, you know, the fact that he doesn't have any weapons on him or anything of that nature, just some candy and an iced tea, you know.
And you're referring to George Zimmerman and the 9/11 transcripts that came out, and we're actually obviously hearing what was said during that 9/11 call, 911 call. Well, what about the conversation that we are having? There are so many articles out there. You just search Trayvon Martin Reality Black or Walking While Black, and you're getting so many articles. So what are your overall thoughts of the conversation thus far, Chris?
About the quality of the conversation?
The quality, is it real? Are we really going as deep as we should be going?
No, I don't think we are going as deep as we should be going. I think it's something that the African-American community takes to heart because, as Unity said, it's something that's part of our community and always has been. But ultimately, I think it has to be a good thing. That it's something that we are prompted to talk about now. Like, why historically this is sparking such a conversation is something that's hard to understand. I think sociologists will probably have a lot more to say about that. But we're noticing that with the response to Question Bridge as well, because here you have the voices of black men presented in a really stark, open, vulnerable way, and the reception to the project has really just been remarkable. And we can only think, well, maybe there's something about this time. Maybe it's the result of Obama's presidency. Maybe it's sort of primed our culture to think about it deeply. I don't know, but I'm glad that it is happening.
So what do you think is missing from the conversation? What do we need to do to go deeper?
Well, I think that, I mean, obviously the white world, you know, the mainstream world needs to think about why profiling is such an instinct. Like, it's reasonable, but it's unjust. We were talking before we went on air that profiling is something that happens instinctively. It happens within the black community as well. And we know that there are structural and sociological and systemic reasons why those conditions happen in the black community. I think all of us need to think deeply about why that's happening and what we can do to raise our own consciousness about changing those underlying conditions.
And what do you think, Unity, about the conversation? What's missing? What makes you hopeful about the conversation we're hearing?
I agree with a lot of what Chris was saying. I feel like the new racism, in a sense, is to deny racism. And it's really important for us to bring up the fact that things like this are still happening based on profiling and not blame it on things like a sweatshirt or, you know, something trivial like that. Because really, the problem is the people who have this mentality to stereotype somebody like me, you know? And like I said, I could be doing the total right thing. I could have millions of dollars and get pulled over while black. Walking while black, that's the term that I heard you use. I've heard driving while black, but walking while black is a new one for me. I could be pulled over and shot, you know, just because I am who I am, you know, and they won't ask questions, you know, because they see a black man in a hoodie, and that's a problem.
So what is your everyday reality like?
My everyday reality? What I really try to do is I try to get into my own art and my own creativity and kind of create my own environment for myself and my family that's kind of separate from all that, you know what I mean? From all that profiling and racism and all that. But, I mean, when I walk out in the streets, when I walk in the store, I still get profiled. Store owners follow me around. It's all the things that you hear us complaining about, but you want to just say that I'm complaining. You know what I mean? I walk across the street, people are locking their car doors. Old ladies are clutching their purses, you know? And they don't know where I'm at or what level I'm at in society or if I taught their kids or who I am, you know? And it's a shame, you know? And I feel that a lot of people can identify with me whether they want to deny it or not. You got black people that want to deny it, you know? You got black people that want to blame this kind of thing on a sweatshirt, you know? And we know better, you know? Because I'm feeling it, you know? No matter how much I try to fit into a white existence or a white mainframe in society, I'm going to feel it, and I'm never going to be that, you know? I'm always going to be who I am, you know? Whether I'm the president of the United States, I'm still going to be looked at, you know, as, you know, the N-word by a lot of people, you know, and that's the unfortunate and sad reality of the situation, you know.
What the conversations that you've had with your parents over the years about this, what do they sound like?
I mean, my grandmother, she's an activist. She's an art activist. She's actually the first black woman in the country to get her PhD in the arts.
Oh, wow.
Dr. Simela Lewis. So I come from kind of like a revolutionary and radical family. And the thing about my family is we never tried to please society with the work that we do. You know what I mean? Like, the work that we do is about helping our people, you know? And, you know, we got to stick together. You know, so that's the mentality that I've been raised with. I was raised Rasta, you know, so I have a large part of me. There's like a huge Afrocentric. The Afrocentric culture runs deep in my veins. You know what I mean? And my name being Unity, it's all about uniting not only my community, but it's also about uniting everybody in the world, you know? But in order for that to happen, we need to have empathy with each other, and we need to be able to look at each other's situations and say, hey, you know, something's not right in society with the way that we're viewing each other, you know, with the way that we're killing our brothers and sisters, no matter what color they are. And that's something that needs to be corrected.
And that is Unity Lewis. He's a hip-hop artist, art educator, and a participant in the Question Bridge Project. Question Bridge Black Males exhibit, now showing at the Oakland Museum. Over 150 black men were interviewed in 11 cities across the United States. And Nubia, we brought you on because you're female, and it's been interesting to watch and listen to this conversation, and it's been very male-dominated for obvious reasons. But what would you like to say about how women of color are treated, or what your daily reality is like?
Well, I feel like it's not something that touches on the aspect of violence. I feel like we're underestimated. Mm-hmm. I personally and just have heard stories from family members where it's like you'll hear, oh, you're not like the rest of them. Like, I graduated high school early. Or I'm speaking properly, proper English, no slang or none of that. And so I'm not like the rest of them, you know? It's just like you're put into a group. And I don't know any personal situations where it's been like I've been pulled over by cops or anything like that. I think that's more of something that is more common for African-American males. Yeah.
Yeah, and that this part of it doesn't really get much attention, what you just explained.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is? Do you talk about it among your friends and family?
Yes, I do. But the reason it doesn't get more attention is because, you know, it's not something, it's something that's been happening since the beginning of America, really, the beginning of slavery and everything like that. So I think because there aren't any lives lost, you know, like I'm not there's no people in my situation who have been killed, and it's been a public thing, you know?
Chris?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that you asked earlier, like what's missing from the conversation, I think a real engagement with the humanity of black men. Because black men aren't offered any easy choices in this culture. If they decide to go, as Unity was saying, in the direction of Afrocentrism as the core of their identity, then they're excluded from the mainstream world. If they make the choice to be part of the mainstream world, then they, in a sense, lose a connection to the community that very often their family came from. And so, you know, that tension between those invidious choices, I think, creates a problem around black men that we're seeing reflected in what happened to Trayvon and what happens to black men every day.
Yeah, and also I feel that so many of our leaders have been shot, murdered. There's no sense of leadership or organization. We're struggling, at least, to find a sense of leadership and organization within our own communities to gather around these issues and really make effective change.
Well, and I'd love to get listeners in on this. When you look at the Trayvon Martin killing and the conversation it has sparked, why now? What is it about that killing that has sparked this conversation and so much media attention? We'd love to hear from you. And what sort of conversation has this sparked within your community? What are you hearing? What conversations are you having? And where do you want this important conversation to go about the realities of walking, driving, being black and brown in our society? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. If you have a personal story you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. If this maybe shifted your opinion, like we heard from this gentleman in the NPR piece who owns a restaurant in Sanford, he said it opened my eyes and made me question my own views. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment so others can read it at yourcallradio.org. The other question I had is, how can we get more people engaged in this conversation? Because NBC and Gallup came out with a poll that found 73% of blacks said they believe George Zimmerman would have been arrested if Trayvon Martin was white, while 33% of whites agreed. The majority of the whites polled, 52%, said race made no difference in this tragedy. So those are very telling numbers. So what can we do to engage more people in this conversation and go a little deeper, as Chris said earlier? 866-798-8255. Chris, what do you make of these numbers? It's a fascinating poll.
Yeah, but it's not surprising.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the mainstream world doesn't realize how implicated they are in the lack of freedom that happens to black men.
Yeah.
Because all of us as a culture are victimized by this.
And we're talking also black and brown, because Native Americans deal with this. I mean, when you were talking about, you know, what happens if you leave your neighborhood or if you get a degree, Native Americans say the same things.
Oh, yeah.
And Latinos face this.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's something that we've been taught to deny, that this is an issue, or that, you know, that race plays a part in this, and we're taught to just trust the media and the government and, you know, whatever their spin is on it, and to go along with that because we don't want to be exiled any more than we already are in society. A lot of us feel that way. Or, you know, there are people that are upholding those beliefs, but it's like those beliefs aren't working for our benefit, for the benefit of us and our community, you know. It's really just creating more situations like this. So,
well, this is the other important question. Because this is getting so much attention, where do you want this conversation to go from here? What changes could we possibly see come out of this?
Well, I think,
Chris.
Yeah, I think once again, it's a question of everybody who's party to this understanding that they have a role to play in it. I think the mainstream world needs to take responsibility for this sort of systemic injustice that produces the crime in black neighborhoods, for example. And like you said, it isn't just black neighborhoods. I think that any marginalized people feel excluded from the mainstream conversation. But I think also the black community needs to take responsibility for its role in this. I think, you know, the family has really been disrupted. I think black women bear the brunt of a lot of the problems that happen to black men.
Mm.
So I think if this is a moment when this issue is sparking an opportunity for soul searching, then I think it's something that we need to take deeper advantage of.
Well, we've got full lines on this, so let's hear from our first caller, Kristen, in San Francisco. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to comment on, like, the problem with profiling. I remember calling the police, like, a month ago about a homeless issue outside of our house, and there was just some yelling and violence, and the first question the police officer asked me was, what color are they? And I feel like there needs to be a systemic shift in the way that we train officers of the law to not ask just solely these questions, you know, what are they wearing? How tall are they? What direction did they head? You know, and because it's thankfully not for me, but for some it's contagious and it like causes fear. And I work at a jail and I'm just saddened by the disproportionate number of African-American women that I see. And I just think that education is liberation. If we can all kind of know our history, maybe we will be less likely to repeat the past. And we have to be responsible for one another and take up for one another, you know?
Well, yeah, thank you for the comment. We're going to take a few more calls and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Carmen in San Francisco. Hi, Carmen. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Hi, my name is Carlin, and I'm calling in. You asked about what kind of conversations it's bringing up, and I just wanted to share a conversation. My daughter must have been, she's a high school student. They must have been speaking about it, this incident or related at school. She came home asking me as the parent, you know, don't you feel like if you see certain people on the street, you have a little extra fear and it's because they're not white? And I said, no. And I said, no, quite honestly. And I feel like I shared with her, like, for me, I'm a little bit influenced with media, and media, the few shows or movies, I'm not a big movie watcher, but the few that I've seen, I see a lot of white mob. I see white people as portrayed in the media as mobsters, gangsters, criminals, things like that. And sometimes I'm more afraid of, I have those kind of fears. And it's not really a color thing, but if it was, I would identify it more with a certain white profile if I was forced to. And that was interesting. So I thought, now why is my daughter thinking the other way? She is actually exposed to much more media and I would think influenced even more by media. And I wondered, media in this case, I don't think is as influential on this topic as you would think, because media is out there. There's much more of a white crime portrayed in the media. Do you see what I'm saying?
I'm trying to understand what you're saying. And also, do you think, Carlin, that this case, this killing, has really prompted you to kind of look at your own daily life and just your perception of people in your everyday life, who you're profiling, who you're not?
No. I'm making much more of a general statement, because I have to be honest, I haven't actually followed this case that much in detail in the media, but I've seen other things living in San Francisco, and somebody brought up the Grant case. I mean, that was a big issue and a big discussion back then.
Right.
I don't think this particular case, no, but just my question is, how media is so penetrating to our society and so overpowering in the messages that it throws out there, and many times mismessages. And here's one where I think if there was going to ever be a message that came from media, it would be more that there's a lot of white crime and white-based it's a different profile. And yet the
All young right, so we'll...
people are walking away with this idea, supposedly, that there's something, a profile or something.
All right, so after the break, we will talk about the influence of media, which we've been talking about. Obviously, that's very important in this case. And the media, they have been really focusing on this issue. Time Magazine, NPR, the Sunday shows, you name it. The question is, where does this conversation go from here, and what could possibly come out of this very important conversation? 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this. We'll be right back.
KLW has a live MP3 stream. You can find us in the public radio listing on iTunes. And if you have an iPhone, you can listen to us via the new Public Radio Tuner application. Learn more at KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about how California Governor Jerry Brown's tax initiative would affect the state's budget if it passes. This would increase the state sales tax and income taxes on California's highest earners. Governor Brown and his allies must collect more than 800,000 signatures by mid-May to qualify for the November ballot. So we'll talk about what's in this ballot. Do you support it? That's tomorrow. Today, we are talking about the realities of walking, driving, being black and brown in our society. The killing of Trayvon Martin has sparked a very important and much needed conversation about race in this country in everyday interactions and in the media. We'll put a bunch of links on our site, yourcallradio.org, after the show. A lot of people, there was a great story by a local TV affiliate, Bay News 9. They interviewed a number of young black boys, and it said that they said the killing has changed their perception of the world. I've never really cared about the looks people gave me, but seeing how people look at you now, it feels like you're being judged. So we're talking about the realities of being a person of color in this country. What conversation has this sparked for you? Has this given you information, or has this kind of made you think about your daily interactions and whether or not you profile people in your daily life? Or if you're black or brown, has this made you more aware of the way that people look at you? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you think about the conversation? Chris said that it needs to go deeper. Do you agree? And where should this go from here? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by three guests. Unity Lewis is a hip-hop artist, painter, art educator, and participant in the Question Bridge Black Males exhibit, which is now showing at the Oakland Museum. Chris Johnson is the co-creator of this exhibit. It collects questions and answers from over 150 black men in 11 cities across the U.S., showing until July 8th. Chris is also professor of photography at the California College of the Arts, and Nubia Bowe is a high school graduate and a Ella Baker Center for Human Rights Heal the Streets Leadership Fellow. And I just got breaking news on my Facebook page. The AP is reporting that Special Prosecutor Angela Corey said she will not take the Trayvon Martin shooting death before a grand jury. She said she continues to investigate the case and will not involve a grand jury that was set to meet tomorrow in Sanford, Florida. She said her decision to skip the grand jury should not be considered a factor in determining whether charges will be filed against George Zimmerman. Chris, quick thoughts on this?
Well, it's discouraging. I think that, you know, until we're willing to look at and address the underlying economic, cultural pressures that are being put on the black family, then I think we're not going to end up having a relevant discussion that can lead to anything meaningful. But everyone understands unfairness when they see it, they feel it. They understand that young kids of color in school are being disproportionately disciplined. And if that's a condition that's an everyday reality for kids, then they're going to act out that pressure and those issues when they grow. And it's just, it's really a shame.
What's your reaction, Unity?
I'm not surprised, but I'm also like, I don't know what we need to do to get the system to change. Like, we need to all unite and do something, because these type of things keep happening, and it seems like nobody's going to do anything about it. It, like, reminds me of the Oscar Grant situation when they moved Measurely's case to somewhere where we knew that he would be protected, you know. And these things, it's just obvious. It's like a blatant slap in the face.
Yeah. According to this AP report, Special Prosecutor Angela Corey took over the case last month after the prosecutor who normally handles cases out of Sanford recused himself. This announcement means the decision on charges now rests solely with the special prosecutor, who had a reputation for not presenting cases before grand juries if it wasn't required. Under Florida law, only first-degree murder cases require the use of grand juries. So this is just coming out from the AP. The special prosecutor will not take the Trayvon Martin shooting death before a grand jury, and we'll put information about this on our website. I wanted to address a couple of the calls we got before the break. We heard from Kristen, who said she was surprised that when she called in, the dispatcher asked her what color was the person she was calling about. Does this surprise you, Chris? Shouldn't color be added to what was this person wearing? How tall were they?
You're asking, like, should race have been considered in the I mean, I think that, I mean, a crime is a crime, obviously, and you would like to think that it's possible to be race neutral in those situations, but it's not surprising.
And obviously, people are kind of struggling with this issue. We heard Carlin call in about her perception and then what her daughter was taught at school, and it sounded like she was struggling to kind of explain her views on this.
That's kind of interesting what she was saying, that from what she sees in the media, that white crime is more prevalent. I feel that's actually kind of perceptive in a way, because historically speaking, I mean, white crime is more prevalent. And in my opinion, black crime is kind of structured, and there's like a place for that in this society, for that to happen. But where I disagree is that in the media, I see black crime used as the scapegoat for a white crime, you know. So I mean the crimes that we do are like, we're like very non-threatening in my opinion. Like black people, like we're still practically in slavery almost, you know what I mean? So it's like when we kill each other, that doesn't really, you know, we're not committing huge crimes against humanity. And I'm not trying to be like, oh, white people are horrible people or anything like that. But I mean, it's not like, I mean, we're going to Europe and putting a bunch of people on a slave ship and dragging them over here and letting thousands of them die in the Atlantic. You know what I mean? Like, I can go back in history and historically trace some pretty horrendous things that have happened. And that's why I'm not surprised that it's still happening today. So, it was actually kind of perceptive to me that she brought that up, you know?
You know, one thing I want to say is that we've mentioned a couple of times the Question Bridge project that's right at the Oakland Museum of California, and I hope people go to see it, because what that represents is an attempt by artists, because I'm part of a team that includes Hank Willis Thomas and Bayte Ross Smith and Kamal Sinclair, who didn't want to get stuck in hopelessness. Mm-hmm. I mean, artists are very often in a position of feeling as if the things that we do are often valuable but not useful. But if what's missing in this conversation broadly is the possibility of really perceiving the humanity of people that we instinctively think of as being other, then I think that does something meaningful to change the conversation. And that's what Question Bridge Black Males attempts to do.
And so you collected questions and answers from over 150 black men in 11 cities across the country. What responses did you get about issues of identity and public space?
Well, identity turned out to be one of the key issues, and the way that it was expressed, sometimes directly, like, for example, questions like, why is it so difficult for African American men to be themselves, their essential selves, and to remain who they truly are? Mm-hmm. Or one really interesting variation was, if all whites were gone, who would you be? So the fact that you see in the Question Bridge installation at the Oakland Museum of California, you see an opportunity for these men to speak to these questions and also provide answers. What that does is it makes it harder to think of these people who you instinctively maybe have resistances against to not accept their humanity when you see them speaking from their heart and with real vulnerability about questions that really address them more than anybody else.
Was there a difference based on geography?
Some, but not really so much. It was really important for us as the artists in this project to get as much regional cultural diversity as possible. We wanted people who see the installation to feel as if they're impressed by the ability to articulate, by the insight, and by the vulnerability of the black men who were in this project, that they could get that same level of engagement for any black men that they saw on the street. And that's what we wanted people to do. We wanted them to be transformed by the experience of being sort of privileged witnesses to a very unique conversation among black men with each other about this process.
And you can see Question Bridge Black Males, the exhibit, at the Oakland Museum. It'll be there until July 8th. And let's go back to callers. Let's hear from Michael in San Francisco. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for the program. Well, of course, we have to go deeper and wider. It's such a huge question, race in America. Good God, where have we been? Let me just say two things. The Stand Your Ground laws are race codified into law. I mean, prejudicial racial views codified into law so that it's vigilanteism allowed to flourish. This is insanity. How did we get this? Right-wing judiciary? Yes, of course. The gun lobby? Yes, of course. Wherever you have a preponderance in the state of right-wing voters? Yes, of course. Well, look, we got problems here. This is just racism. Of course, if you turned it around, Trayvon's 45 and Mr. Zimmerman's 17 and white, oh, forget about it. Trayvon would be in jail right now for sure. It's the shadow. You can't... The white society will not accept this. So much to say about this matter. It's way, way too much to...
Well, you're right, and we've got just about 15 minutes left. But what do you think about the conversation we're having right now, Michael, and where do you want this to go from here?
Well, I love the idea that you have, that this arts group got together, get all different colored people into, colors of people into art groups, theater groups, things like this. At least some understanding will come out of it. Some sort of a balanced presentation of the human spirit. And so you get away from this idea of skin color, number one. Yes, it can be championed in one way. We all bring from our heritages. But this idea about white superiority and projecting all negativity onto the black or the colored is insanity. How do you get away with it? Start with the arts. That's great. Go yoga, integrated yoga circles. I'm just coming off the top of my head now. I want to say just one last thing. Selma James was in town for about 2 weeks, and she's the Marxist feminist who was married to C.L.R. James. Mm. And she had wonderful things to say about integrated labor groups who got so much more done than playing, allowing the class, the people at the top of the class pyramid to play racial differences off. And so that's also
right.
Very, very important.
Well, thank you for calling in, Michael. We'll take a few more calls. Let's hear from Maryam Anna. Hi, Maryam. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking the call. I call because I think the issues are not really very clear. The reason I make that statement is that when this country was colonized, it was colonized by people who were immeasurably more impoverished than the conditions of the people who were brought here to act as their labor. That is to say that they were considered the slave class of Europe and basically were on the level of refuse. So until and unless Europeans who came here, and you remember, of course, the Statue of Liberty in the port of New York, opening her arms to all of those who were disenfranchised from Europe to come here, until that kind of attitude toward people from Europe has changed within themselves and their spirits emboldened with a sense of personal value outside of materialism, outside of money, there's going to be some scapegoating of anyone who is the other as identified by color. So until and unless we can change that kind of consciousness within the people who were originally colonized and brought here to work as labor for money for Europe, there's not going to be any significant change.
Well, thank you for calling. Chris, do you agree with that?
Well, obviously, if the point she's making is that the original colonizers of this country came here voluntarily under pressure from Europe, that's true, but they did come voluntarily. Mm-hmm. That's different than being enslaved. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for the call, Maryam. We've got full lines, and I want to make sure we get as many people as we can on the line. We've got about 10 minutes left. So let's hear next from Asia in Oakland. Hi, Asia.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. Listening to your conversation, you know, I just want to say that, you know, I live in a community where probably 90% of the people around me that I engage with are of other race, predominantly white, over here by Piedmont in Oakland. But, you know, there's no discussion going on among my neighbors about this issue. And I would like to say that, you know, I'm almost 70 years old this year if I live. And I would like to say that if you had polled the American people in 1854 Dred Scott decision, you would found that it's probably the same number now, like 90% or 80% would say that, you know, slavery is okay. And I feel that why individually we may get along, but there's a group think or thought that occurs, you know, against people of other color in this country. Thank you.
I think there's something interesting in what he just said, and I think it's true that it's easier to get along individually because we're dealing with people that we know. Again, we're engaged with their humanity than it is to function as a group. I think that one of the things that is conceptually at the heart of Question Bridge Black Males is that we begin with questions. I think creating a space where it's possible to ask questions is probably the only creative thing that we can do, because the answers require real spiritual and deep social and economic change, and that's harder to do.
And Nubia, I want to bring you back in here. Are you hearing conversations about these issues with your circle of friends and your family?
Yes, definitely. Working with the Ella Baker Center, we brought it up in a couple of meetings, and, you know, we all just shared our point of view about the whole incident. And a lot of people have said that if he was another race, like white or Asian or any other race besides African American, then he probably wouldn't have gotten shot.
And where are you and your friends and your community hoping this conversation goes from here?
I'm just hoping that it will, you know, raise awareness.
Raise awareness?
Yes. About the lack of value on the black life.
I mean, I think that's a really important concept, the idea of raised awareness. I mean, if every person who encounters another black person on the street is a little bit more conscious of their own instinct to pull away and be defensive, then I think that changes an underlying condition slowly, incrementally, that hopefully will result in a systemic change eventually.
And now I'd like to welcome Abel, who's calling in from the Ella Baker Center. And Abel was also part of the Question Bridge Black Males exhibit. Hi, Abel. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, Rose? Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you for joining us. So you've got an interesting story about your reality of growing up as a black boy, a black man. What would you like to share with us about the realities, what you deal with on a daily basis?
Absolutely. Well, just really quickly, I think Question Bridge, it was a great honor to be a part of it, and I think it's going to be one of those projects that we're going to be talking about years from now, one of the most instrumental projects and one of the most important projects of our time, because I think, as Chris mentioned, it's one of the few opportunities in my lifetime where I had the opportunity to talk amongst other black men about being black. And what it means and the struggles. I would just point out, my family comes from Ethiopia originally, and I remember early on having a conversation with my father about what it meant to be black here in the United States and how protective he was. You know, my father was very familiar with the stories of Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, but it was this weird conversation where he was trying to basically explain to me, for my own protection, what I needed to know, because you'll be perceived by the color of your skin. And it's just a conversation that I will never forget, and being taught, you know, as I grew older, that, you know, you're basically going to walk into a room already prejudged, predetermined and pre-valued, and for a lot of times undervalued. And you consistently have to deal with these distractions, so much so that you're playing this game in your head while you're sitting at an interview thinking about everything except for the skills that you're actually going to have to be presenting on, because you're thinking about how you're sitting, how you're walking, what you'll be identified by, what you look like. And all these distractions, I think, are consistent for a lot of black males on the daily. And it's really, you know, heartbreaking, I think, in many ways. And we were mentioning that where do we want to see this conversation move towards? And I think somebody had brought up that it's my hope that we continue this conversation into education access, into affirmative action, into the pipeline that are so many of our youth are getting into due to over discipline, and as well as the increasing incarceration rates. I think this
Abel,
conversation needs to continue.
I understand you also have an interesting quick story about your interactions on BART.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine launched this project, I think, on Tumblr, which was basically "Sit next to me, I'm safe," which was just this conversation about the fact that a lot of black men have an empty seat next to them on BART. And if you notice, that it's a very obvious thing, and how suspicious and how threatening we may be, no matter how filled it is, the BART train. And I take BART every day, and that happens to me on the daily. So, it's very concerning, and it's also something again that we're aware of, and that we have to have this conversation in our head about how we look and how suspicious we may be.
Mm. Well, thank you so much, Abel. It's a very interesting project to look around BART and look where people sit and where they don't sit. Chris, you haven't been able to share many of your interactions. You've been talking about the people you've interviewed, but what about you personally? How have you been affected?
Well, you know, personally, I mean, I have the privilege of teaching at a beautiful school
California College of the Arts.
It gives me a chance to play the role of mentor and teacher. In my own personal life, my family's in Brooklyn. But leaving Brooklyn was a real decisive thing for me when I left in 1968. Coming to California was a really liberating diaspora for me. But I think, like a lot of people, I personalize this issue in spiritual terms. I mean, it's really something that all of us are trying to raise awareness of. I mean, you want to be on the right side of history. And I think people who understand that instinctively they are not supporting underlying political and social changes that could lead in the direction of justice are defensive because they know that they're ultimately losing. And I think personally trying to be as effective a consciousness raiser is what I try to do every day.
Mm. Well, let's take a few more calls and then we'll get final thoughts from our guests. Let's hear from Gail in San Mateo. Hi, Gail. Oh, sorry about that. Gail wanted to talk about getting white people into this discussion to help solve racism. So that's, do you have thoughts on this, Chris?
Well, you know, this project that that I and Hank and Kamal and Biotay are involved with is called Question Bridge : Black Males. The colon is important because the methodology of simply being open to creating a safe place for people to ask and answer questions for each other applies to not just blacks. We began with blacks because the core artists are black males, and so it made sense to do that. But we think the methodology could apply to any racial group. Creating a safe place for meaningful dialogue, which is exactly what this program does, mm-hmm. I think itself is a revolutionary gesture that ultimately has to pay off.
We've got a couple emails I wanted to read. Gerald says, I am the white father of a black adult son. I am also a clinician working with refugee survivors of torture. I think the case has gained notoriety because of the law permitting citizens to carry arms and decide for themselves whether to use them in proximity to others they fear or dislike. This is a step up from previous laws and actions under them, and everyone knows it. There is an intuitive understanding of the change. It's like the use of torture by the government now, where it's a matter of legally justified public policy to use torture. We all intuitively could say this is a major change. Part of what is to be done is what you are doing. Expose the change, debate it, not accept it passively as forced bystanders. It's a great point about the stand your ground laws. That's probably another reason why this case is getting so much attention, because these
stand your ground laws are passing across the country. Robert says, we've heard this conversation about race and profiling for decades now. Why is it that the racial wound in America only gets worse? It's time to rise above conversations of race and identity to conversations of class. Presenting racism is not the, quote, core of American society. The core is capitalism, which puts the color green ahead of everybody.
And racism is a tool that they use to divide the classes. So, you know, it's like interwoven.
I guess I'd recommend people read Howard Zinn, because he has a lot of very insightful things to say about exactly that point.
And Martin writes, when I arrived in this country from England in 58, I lived with some college students on Chicago's South Side. I got a night job that required taking the L, and I walked several blocks to the station. One day, I was walking alongside a black guy who was carrying a set of bongo drums. I asked him if he's going to play in one of the local clubs. He stopped and looked at me in amazement. "You're not American," he stated. I explained I was English. "You mean they talk to black people over there?" he said. That encounter still fills me with sadness. I believe we've made some progress, but my God, it is slow, especially when you consider the only real difference is pigmentation that regulates the amount of vitamin D we absorb from the sun. Well, thank you for that email, Martin. And we've only got a couple minutes left. Does this really come down to personal experience? Because I have Native American relatives who deal with this stuff on a regular basis. My brother's been pulled over a lot. My father's been pulled over in his work truck when he goes to, you know, wealthy neighborhoods. The company name is on the truck. The tools are in the back of the truck. And the cop says, "What are you doing here?" Yeah. So is it all about your personal experience?
Yeah, I think it absolutely does come down to your personal experience. I think every single individual has to touch that instinct of justice. They know when they are feeling a defensive reaction that's not based on any direct experience. Everyone knows that. The question is, what do you do with that habit?
Well, all right, so what do we do from here? What do we do to make sure this conversation doesn't go away, and where does it need to go from here?
Well, we certainly can focus on the underlying political issues, and like you said, the stand your ground issues have a lot to do with it. I mean, if that can become a catalyst for reconsideration of why defensiveness is such a problem in our culture, that would be good.
And Nubia, what would you add to that? Where does this conversation go from here?
Well, I feel like the conversation is not going to end, honestly. I feel like we're just going to keep having the same conversation. There'll be another situation just like this a year from now or however long. And I just feel like until we address the issues of white supremacy, then, you know, nothing will be solved.
And Unity?
I totally agree with that, and I feel that we need to keep having these conversations, because the more we have them, the better we get at articulating ourselves and defining exactly what the problem is, and the better we get at pinpointing that and, you know, handling it. So.
That's Unity Lewis. He's a hip-hop artist, participant in the Question Bridge Black Males exhibit, now showing at the Oakland Museum through July 8th. Chris Johnson co-created the exhibit. He's also professor of photography at the California College of the Arts. And Nubia Rowe is a fellow at the Ella Baker Center. She works with the Heal the Streets Leadership Program. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for your emails and phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How would California Governor Jerry Brown's tax initiative affect the state's budget? On the next Jura Call, we'll have a conversation about the compromise measure that would increase the state sales tax and income taxes on California's highest earners. Governor Brown and his allies must collect more than 800,000 signatures by mid-May to qualify for the November ballot. So who will benefit if this initiative passes, and who will be left behind? Do you support it? It's your call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.